Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. And joining us today is Robin Hatcher. Robin is the author of Standing Ovation Presentations, Discover Your Unique Actor Type and Let It Shine. Robin, thank you very much for being with us here today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, Robin, as we know, and you especially, because you've been a voice coach, you've been a teacher, you've been an actress, a little bit of everything, that people, according to psychology today, would rather be dead than speak.
And yeah.
They'd rather be in the coffin than speak the eulogy.
Yeah, that's Jerry's Seinfeld's joke. Yeah, they'd rather be in the coffin at the funeral than up there talking. Yeah, it's a huge fear. And it's very complicated fear, honestly, and people have it for different reasons. A lot of people have that fear because of something that happened in their past, is something that they, you know, like we get these neurons in our brain that fire when an experience happens to us. And a lot of people, as a child, may have started to talk or been knocked down or something like that, and that's one of the experiences that stick, and then they think every time I stick my neck out, every time I stand in front of people, I'm going to be made fun of. And so that's one reason why that happens. The other thing, it's like we're just so unused to being exposed, and it feels like you're being naked up there when you're speaking. And what I do, and what I really tell my clients and everyone that I train, is that one way to try to combat that fear is to take the camera lens, like the camera lens is pointed at us most of the time when we're up there in our fear state. And that camera lens expands. It's like where there's this close-up of us. It's like, oh, how do I look? How do I sound? What's going on? What are they thinking of me, 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 me? And my suggestion, which really helps in a lot of cases, is that when you switch that camera around and point it at your audience or your listener or your subject or whatever, and you think, wow, what am I giving them? What are they thinking? How can I help them? How can I improve their lives? That's a whole different energy, and your energy is no longer on me, 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 but it's on them, which is where it should be.
But it's interesting. One of the things that you mentioned in your book is that a large percentage of the communication is nonverbal.
Exactly. Yes, and in test after test, research study after research study, between 80 and 90% of communication is communicated before you even open your mouth or by the tone of your voice. So it doesn't mean that you can speak gibberish and be understood and be acknowledged, but what it means is that if we have a choice about what we see and what we hear about someone's communication, we're going to choose what we see and hear to believe rather than the words coming out of your mouth because of the nature of the way the human mind is made up. You know, we're trained to survive. And our survival mechanism is based on a very primitive part of our brain that reacts to the visual and the vocal first to assess whether it should be afraid or whether it should embrace that person. And so if you can't get through that fear factor, that primitive brain, then you're climbing an uphill battle with whatever it is that you're saying. So I really believe that we need to get so much in touch with how we physically come across. And there are tricks that I have in the book and that I do in my trainings and my coachings that help people to look more confident. And in looking more confident, they actually become more confident because the brain doesn't know the difference sometimes between how you're acting and how you actually are.
Flipping the coin around, sometimes the people in the audience are going, oh no, a speaker.
Yeah.
We're going to be here forever. And Senator Bob Dole once said, a speaker is like a corpse at a funeral home. Everyone expects you to be there, but they don't expect you to say much. And as far as the audience, sometimes they look forward to a speaker because he's short and to the point. Mm-hmm. But especially at commencement ceremonies, some of these, especially politicians or dignitaries, feel like they have to throw in all this data and all this important information, knowing that the kids out there just want to get out of there and celebrate.
Right. Yeah, there are ways of sharing information. It's like one of my signature talks is stop presenting and start engaging. And the other thing is even for teachers and stop teaching, start inspiring. I feel like when people are engaged, they can listen forever. And I love the fact that I just had a feedback. Somebody at a presentation, and I was so shocked and pleased. She said I could listen to her forever. So the thing is, it's like if you can engage the emotions of the people that you're talking to and flip the, most people think that it's all about the data, like you said. It's like all about how much I know, how many facts I can spill out. But if those facts are not touching your audience in some emotional way that says, I need this, or I want this, or this is going to help me, this is going to change me, this is going to inspire me, they don't care about the data. They're not going to hear it. They're not going to listen to it. They're not even going to absorb it. So short and sweet is great if it needs to be short and sweet, but inspiring and engaging is, I think, the mother load.
Well, you know, one of the things that I tell my students, because I teach announcing and voice acting as well, and I tell them, speak to express, not to impress.
Yes.
Because a lot of people, as you mentioned, they want to spill out that data, or they want to use these big words that sometimes they don't even know what they mean.
Right.
And the audience doesn't want to be having a thesaurus right next to
them. Right, yeah. And as soon as they get a word that they don't know, what happens in the brain starts to filter and start to think and starts to process things and try to figure it out, and then they miss the next two or three sentences that you've said. So they're out of it. That it becomes a real distraction when people in the business world, where there are so many acronyms and jargon depending on the industry, and people love to do it because it makes them feel like they know the business. But if there's a 1% chance that somebody in your audience does not understand that jargon, explain it or don't use it, because otherwise you've lost a percentage of that audience, and you can't afford to do that because the energy in the whole room is going to change.
In your book, Standing Ovation Presentations, the preface, you talk a little bit about determining our actor types. Could you explain that, please?
Yes. Growing up and teaching, I've had several jobs that all have led to this. I was a professional actor for years, like you mentioned. I wrote for film, television, soap operas, and I started teaching English as a second language. And as I was teaching, I realized that I would work with people from Russia, China, Japan, Korea, all these different places. And each class, I would find somebody that, wow, he reminds me of this person, or he reminds me of that person. And when I was writing for the soaps, I would have to write different characters, and each character had to have their own voice coming from their own strengths, their own personalities. So I started putting two and two together when I sat down to write the book. And I realized, it's like, I feel like we all have a specific style. And as an actor, the same thing. It's like there would be auditions and there would be what's called a breakdown. In the breakdown, they would call for this type of person. And if you didn't fit that type of person, it would be a waste of your time to go in for that audition. But what I was experiencing as a young actor, people would always say, oh, I can do that. It's no problem. I can do that role. And what I realized after all of my teaching and all of my training and writing, you know what? Basically, we all can't do everything. We need to be true to what we are. And so I developed the 9 actor types based on what I saw in television and TV, what I saw in front of me in classrooms, and who I saw in my immediate circle of friends and acquaintances. And what I devised is that there are 9 specific types. And there, you know, the archetypes has been around for years. I also studied a lot of personality assessments with my business training, like the DISC and the Myers-Briggs. And putting that all together, the actor types is a fun way of describing strengths and personalities and qualities and fatal flaws that individuals have and exhibit on a day-to-day basis, and letting them really find out who it is that they are, where's their strength, polishing it, and letting go of any weaknesses.
Would you mind please describing the 9 actor types and then perhaps give us some examples of, I guess, politicians or personalities so we can kind of associate those?
Sure. Okay, I'll start with the buddy. So we have the buddy who is everybody's friend, and you think of the buddy when I have a slideshow. I think of the Seth Rogen characters. I have this photo of him with his arm around James Franco in one of those movies. It's like they're buds. They want to support each other. They always are there to support. They go the extra mile. And if you think about those kind of people and in the movies, you think, wow, they're the people that you know, they get taken advantage of by the mean guys or the bullies or something because they're always wearing their hearts on their sleeves and they're always there. And as a personality type, it's great because you're very friendly, you're very supportive, you're very empathetic. And one of the fatal flaws with the buddy, of course, is that you can get walked over, you can get taken advantage of, and it's very difficult for very strong buddy identification. You know, and most of us are a combination of one or two types. It's like we have a primary and then we have a secondary and then we have all these other types too that show up from time to time. But when your primary is buddy, it's very difficult sometimes for you to ask for what you want, what you need, and that's our buddy. And then we have the opposite of the buddy might be the villain. And the villain is the polar opposite of the hero. And people are often surprised and feel like the villain is negative. But I don't see the villain as negative. The villain is a very strong, commanding presence with charisma up the wazoo. It's just the type of charisma that it puts people a little bit off and wondering whether I should come forward or should I come next. But it's also very exciting. So when you think of one of the top villain characters is a character like Michael Douglas in Greed, you know, or Michael Douglas in a lot of different roles. It's like they've got this strong, really charismatic presence, and they don't have to move. They don't have to do a lot. They have a dry sense of humor, a dry wit. They're very sharp. They're very quick. And, of course, there's the downside of that, of being intimidating. And then let's go to the hero, which the hero of every film is the person that the camera zooms in on as soon as the film starts. And, you know, we have heroes, and Michelle Obama is like a hero, and we have these wonderful heroes and heroines that can walk in and be warm and charismatic and strong all at the same time and have people want to follow them, want to be attracted to them. And what happens with the hero is sometimes we're so used to being heroic and saving the day and being the star that we often forget to show our vulnerability, show our soft side, show our Achilles heel, which is a death knell for a hero or heroic character, because if your audience cannot feel your pain or understand your pain or really know your story, they'll start to turn off. And there's a superhero, which is different than the hero. And when you think of a superhero, you think of the heyday, the Ralph Nader types. You know, they're out there. They really want to make a difference. They go charging in to try to right wrongs and set things straight and to expose problems. You know, we've got the Nancy Grace, all of those people that go in guns a-blazing. And that's a very successful type. They get things done. They're very respected. And what happens with the superhero is they often are so used to that anxiety, that drama, that heightened sense of purpose that they see it where it doesn't exist. And one of the examples I always like to give is like a hero might burst into a room with their fire axe and their fire hose and start spraying and start hacking down walls. And then they just realize that somebody is sitting there with a candle lit. You know, it's not a big fire. And that's one of the things that the superhero is like. And then we have the curmudgeon, which I love, and that's someone that doesn't need to be older, but somebody who's been around, a veteran, knows their stuff, but doesn't really care what people think of them, doesn't care about how they look, how they present, how they sound, whether they're heard, whether they're seen. They just want to get the stuff done, and they know what they know, and they don't suffer fools lightly. And the curmudgeon is a great character, but of course it can be thought of as being grumpy, stodgy, overlooked, unkempt. All of that are the fatal flaws of certain curmudgeon types. We also have the ingenue, or the innocent, who is very optimistic all the time, sees the good in everything, asks a lot of questions, is super sweet. Like when people say, oh, she's so sweet, oh, she's so nice, or he's so nice. Ingenues can be male as well. And some of the ingenues out there are, you know, if you think of the actress Zoe Deschanel in that show, or the guy who played Kenneth in 30 Rock, they're just so sweet and open and great, and they can often be taken for being foolish or silly or young or stupid, really. And so with ingenues, it's very critical for them to start working on some of their other characteristics, their strengths and their voice and their physical attributes that will make them seem more grounded and more serious. And we have the comic that everybody wants to be a jokester. Everybody wants to be funny. There are some, like, comic politicians, but mostly you'll see the comic in other areas as the, you know, the Robin Williams types that you get him on a panel and you just can't shut him up. And so that's a type that you can imagine what that fatal flaw is. And one of another popular type would be the whiz kid, which is when you think of somebody like Rachel Maddow or even Al Gore or Steve Jobs. They're people that have an enormous amount of knowledge and a lot of data. And remember how Al Gore got lambasted repeatedly because he was a data dumper. You know, he had no charisma. It's like, and what he did, his intelligence, he would just dump the data. And one of the things that whiz kids don't realize is that what we were talking about before is that you really need to engage your audience and your listener emotionally in order for them to be able to accept any data that you're spouting. So that's the whiz kid. And the sex symbol and the supermodel sex symbol. And those are the people that, you know, they are all about how things look. They're very attractive usually, but they don't necessarily need to be. You want to think about those people that looks are supreme. And the latest in media, the latest car, the latest this, all of their materials are ship-shaped. They have the highest quality of everything. And those are great. And like we talked about, visual is so important. But a lot of times people will overlook the intelligence of a supermodel because they think that the cover is everything and there's nothing underneath that. And a lot of female politicians will fall into that trap if they're really attractive. All those newscasters that had gotten really upset because people think that because they're beautiful, they can't be smart. I think that's all nine. Did I miss anything?
No, I think you did. But I had a question. What about the difference between a hero and the superhero?
Right. The superhero has that uber energy that is there to fix things, to change things. So really the difference between Superman versus Tom Hanks. You know, Tom Hanks is never going to be Superman. He's never going to be a superhero, but he is going to be a hero. So the superhero is that personality type that really charges in, is a very clipped speaker, wants to get things done, ASAP, does not have the same amount of empathy or the same amount of charisma as the hero does. Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
One of the things that you talked about earlier is confidence and presence and presentation, and people are fine talking, but once they get in front of a microphone and they see the audience, they sometimes freak out.
Right.
In your book, you also mentioned the three Vs. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, the three Vs are essential. The three Vs of effective communication are the visual component, the vocal component, and the verbal component. So the visual is everything that we see, down your facial expression, your gestures, your body language, your posture, your seated position, your clothing. Everything that we see is in the visual cortex. Then we've got the vocal cortex, which is what we hear. That's your accent, your intonation, which is critical, the sound of your voice, the pitch of your voice, the resonance of your voice. All of those things go into the vocal channel. And with those two channels, the visual and the vocal, are two of the ways that people judge whether you are safe or whether you are going to be fodder for them. And then the verbal are the actual words that are coming out of your mouth, the actual words that are spoken, the vocabulary, the pronunciation, all of that or the sentence choices, the sentence construction, the grammar. That's all the verbal channel. And in my book, I also mentioned that the three Vs are classic, and every presentation coach is going to talk to you about them at some point. And I add a fourth V, which is your V of value. You know, what value are you bringing to the conversation? and what values do you live and breathe by?
One of the things that you mentioned is the verbal, and you mentioned that in your book, is that you have to realize who your target audience is, mm-hmm. what their perspective is, what their frame of reference is, because if you're speaking to a group of farm workers, it's going to be very different from a group of farmers.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You really need to know your audience. That goes for whether you're doing a presentation, whether you're at work doing a one-on-one, and that's the other place where the actor types come in. So it's not just about learning about what your actor type is, but when you look through the actor types and the explanation that I have, you really also need to think about who you are interacting with on a daily basis. And when you know who you're interacting with, that should shape how you present, what word choices you use, how quickly you get to your point, or how much rapport is needed. So in a presentation, yes, a lot of times what will happen if you don't know your audience, ask questions before it's time for you to present. Or if you don't have that luxury, a lot of times when I'm doing a presentation, I'll send a survey if it's a small presentation and I have control, and find with some questions who these people are, what do they know, what do they need to know. And that's going to be really helpful going in. If you don't know that, as a presenter, you need to be so flexible. Most of the time in the beginning of my presentations, if I don't know the audience, I'll do some sort of a how many of you polling right there before I begin my presentation. And then I'm flexible enough to know that I'm going to add this part or spend more time on that part depending on who's in front of me.
Robin, what about visual? A lot of people, when they go and speak in front of someone, and especially men, they feel like they have to wear a suit. What about clothing?
Yeah. Clothing is very specific to the situation and who it is that you are. That's another great way to use your actor type. For instance, first of all, just the blanket rule of thumb is when you're presenting in front of an audience that you need to find out how that audience dresses on the whole. A lot of times I'll recommend if you're going into a corporation, you don't know, call them up. It's like, what's the dress culture there? Find out what it is. And then you want to go a step above that. So if they're in jeans, you can wear slacks and a nice shirt, because if you're talking to a bunch of farmers and you show up in an Armani suit, already that's going to have that sort of distancing effect. And their first impression, which happens in 2 to 7 seconds, is going to be, oh, he's above me, and it's going to take you a long time to overcome that perception. So suits are not necessarily what you need to do. And like I said, the actor type is really important. What I discovered in myself, and there's an exercise in the book that will tell you, has a whole list of adjectives, and then give you an exercise of how to really assess how you should dress, what colors and what shapes, what fabrics, all of those things. When I first started out working with corporations and in offices and things like that, I always thought that I had to wear a suit, you know, this tailored suit. And as I was doing it, I felt not so comfortable all the time in that, because my personality isn't suit-like. Now, I can still be very professional looking, and when I say suit-like, it's not the classic suit shape doesn't work for me. Because I have a lot of flow in what I do, I have a lot of dynamism in what I do, that doesn't translate with a blue or black or gray suit jacket. So what I learned to do was, instead of jackets, a lot of times I'll wear a softer sweater that have that movement to it but still has some sort of structure. I always will wear color, which will signal that, you know, this is not your everyday trainer type of person. She has some energy around her. And so what I recommend as far as dressing, you want to know who your audience is, dress a step above that, and then make sure that your value and your personality is somehow coming through in the way that you dress. So if I had to wear a suit, I would wear a suit with a red jacket. If I were a guy and I had to wear a suit, I'd wear a suit with a really, really great looking tie.
Getting back to verbal, I'm sure you go through it in your classes and in your presentations, and that is dialect and speech patterns. And we all know that some people speak a certain way and they just can't change it. And then some people who are very successful, like President Kennedy, was a great speaker, but you could tell that he was from Boston because right. he said, Mr. Castro and Cuber, and we need to do this. So is that important as far as changing your dialect?
I have several clients that I'm working with them on that right now because we do judge people by dialect and sound and stuff. However, you can compensate for that. Kennedy compensated for that with his personality, with his charisma. So his visual was working so well that that verbal did not interfere with him. And some organizations have come to me and said, I have this guy, I really like him, but clients are judging him based on this dialect that he has. So what can you do? And the thing is, everything can change. Everything can soften. I develop exercises. I develop drills and skills for them to really work on repositioning their tongue, repositioning their mouth, all of that stuff to really try to soften a dialect. And then in some instances, I know with a lot of my English as a second language students, then I'll have them do other things to compensate visually or slow down and use the tone that is going to be more definitive and more confident sounding so that people's ear will then not dwell on the accent as much as they will dwell more on the content. You can really strengthen those skills so that other weakness, as we might call it, will then be minimized in comparison.
Well, Robin, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here this afternoon. We've been visiting with Robin Hatcher. Robin is the author of Standing Ovations, Presentations, Discover Your Unique Actor Type and Let It Shine. And you can find her book on Amazon.com or any of the other booksellers, including small bookstores, which, of course, author James Patterson is promoting. And she has her own Facebook page, so you can follow her there as well. Robin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
KTEP Summer Book Club has been well received by you, the listener, and this, along with other author conversations, are in the Perspectives Archives on KTEP.org. Follow us on Facebook in order to keep up with the latest chats Louis has with a wide range of writers, novelists, and more. And if you have a suggestion for an author for Louis to talk with, use the Contact Us button on our website or shoot Louis a message on Facebook. Thanks so much for listening to Perspectives.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu.
And a producer's note, this week's show was edited by June Urbina.
You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.